Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audiobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
David Rosenhaus took on Donald Trump in one of the most famous cases in New York City real estate history, when Donald Trump wanted to demolish a Central Park South apartment building. David Rosenhaus saved the tenants from Trump's wrecking ball. Crane's Business called Rosenhaus the most feared tenant attorney in New York City, a lawyer powerful landlords and developers dread facing in court. Rosenhaus has saved thousands of homes and made millions of dollars for tenants and for himself. David, welcome. Taking on Donald Trump, that must have been some case.
It was a difficult and complicated case. Donald Trump bought a building at 100 Central Park South, which had rent-regulated tenants, and he decided he wanted to evict the tenants and demolish that building and combine it with the Barbizon next door. And he brought a proceeding at DHCR, which is the state agency that runs rent control and rent stabilization, in order to evict those tenants. We represented those tenants in that proceeding. And we were successful in protecting their homes.
And that was when?
He brought the proceeding, my recollection, he brought the proceeding, I think, in 1984, and it took several years. To defend the tenants in that case.
Why was that case important?
Let me just say, every case where developers try to evict rent-regulated tenants whose apartments and their status will never be restored is important. Because rent control and rent stabilization is slowly disappearing, and it's important to protect those tenants against eviction.
At one point, wanted to bring in homeless people, did he not?
He did propose to the city that he will bring homeless people into the building. He volunteered to bring homeless people into the building. Obviously, everybody recognized the fact that was an attempt to try to drive the tenants who live in the building out of the building.
He did a whole lot of other things as well to try to convince them to leave, for example.
He ultimately brought a RICO action against me and my former firm. My recollection, it was for
racketeering
influence. He brought an action in federal court. My recollection, it was for $105 million. I recall it was Whitman Knapp was the judge who was, prior to that, the head of the Knapp Commission.
Which investigated police corruption
in New York City, and was a very smart and very good judge, and he threw the case out.
That's kind of intimidating. How'd you feel about that?
I don't get intimidated easily, but obviously it is not a pleasure to have to defend any case. We had to retain attorneys to represent us, but ultimately that case was dismissed, and he ultimately paid our attorney's fees.
How did he deal with you? How did you deal with him? What is it like going up against someone like Trump, who's insisted after all the tenants, after you won the case, he said, I won.
He didn't win the case. I negotiated with him directly. He has a very good sense of the vulnerability of his opponent. He has a very good sense on how to get leverage. So in this campaign, when he created names for his opponents.
What was the name for you?
There was no name for me. But I think bringing the action, the RICO action against me and my firm, was sort of a precursor to his sense as to how you get things done.
Well, it is a very important subject. People don't know about that Donald Trump. Is that Donald Trump any different than this one? Than the one we have today, 2016?
As I said, I dealt with him in the 1980s. He was much younger, but, you know, the tactics that he used in the campaign, in a sense, was similar to the tactics he used in the case I had against him.
Were there any real problems that you had to get over in order to finish this particular case, the one involving Hunter Central Park South?
We succeeded in convincing the agency that he did not meet the standards he had to meet in order to evict the tenants. There's law defining what a demolition of a building is, and one of the things that the developer has to prove, the agency, is that he's actually demolishing the building and building a new building on the site. And the law is that you do not have to demolish the four outside walls of a building to be considered the demolition. But there's a case that stated that if you stood in the basement and looked up, you should see the sky, which means all the slabs, everything should be demolished except for the four floors. We basically showed that the plans that he filed with the Department of Buildings and filed with the agency did not meet that standard. His own plans, I assume that he got legal advice from someone. He did not get very good legal advice because his own plans proved that he did not meet the standard, which the law set for evicting tenants on the ground you're going to demolish a building.
And the standards for the building were pretty good. The building never was demolished, and his son moved into the 13th floor, right? They were
true. That's what I've heard. I mean, the building was not demolished. The rent-regulated tenant stayed. They got leases and had a right to continue living there. And ultimately, he did condo the building, and the tenants who lived there wanted to purchase, could purchase, and some did and some didn't. But the ones who didn't were protected. It was a non-eviction plan. They could live there for the rest of their lives.
Donald Trump is just one of the people that you dealt with in New York City and all the various fights, and there are so many of them, the Museum of Modern Art expansion, the Mayflower Hotel. I guess people know about that one. That was the one that became 15 Central Park West.
Yes.
I think actually Derek Jeter lived in that. And the son of General MacArthur. Quite a group. What was that like?
That was interesting. That is a good example as to what you have to do to represent tenants effectively in demolition cases. It was a hotel. At the end, there were two tenants in the building. I represented one. Another law firm represented the other tenant. The other tenant got there were settlement discussions. The other tenant got, my understanding, $600,000 to surrender his apartment, paid the legal fees, apparently had some money left over after paying taxes to buy something. When he got $600,000, I already rejected $5 million. My client got over $17 million, plus a $2 million apartment in the Essex House for $1 a month for the rest of his life.
Very nice. And you got some money as well, right?
I do these cases on many of them on a contingency basis, and I made a very substantial fee, but I deserved a very substantial fee.
One-third. Actually, working for the underdog does pay, doesn't it?
It is nice to be able to work for the underdog and not evict old ladies and make money in the process.
But New York City is real estate, real estate, just real estate, real estate, real estate, isn't it?
It is. There is, especially now, as you can see, the cranes all over every avenue. There's tremendous amount of development over the last several years. The rumor is that it's slowing down on the upper ends of the market, meaning Central Park South, the super expensive buildings where apartments are selling for $7,000 and $8,000 a foot. That is slowing down, but there's a lot of development, a lot of development going on.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Our guest is David Rosenholz, a lawyer who specializes in representing tenants in tenant-landlord cases. But your life started somewhere in Asia, did it not?
It did.
Tell us a little bit more about that life.
Well,
life that I don't think too many people know about. Well, maybe it made you the tough guy you are today.
My father was born in Poland. My mother was born in Bessarabia. In 1939, my father crossed from Poland into Russia. Russia and Germany had a non-aggression pact at the time. He was arrested at the border, was accused of being a spy, and was convicted. My understanding was actually convicted in some sort of a proceeding of being a spy and was sent to Siberia.
The Gulag.
Sent to Gulag in Siberia. My mother was, as I said, born in Bessarabia, which was Romania at the time. In 1940, the Russians went into Bessarabia. In 1941, the Germans head towards Bessarabia, you know, they get into war with Russia. My mother is, at the time, she's in boarding school. Her father was, you know, a merchant, was well off. They left everything and started heading into Asia. And my mother and her father and her mother basically walked and rode horses and took trains at times and went all the way from Bessarabia into Central Asia. The Germans never crossed the Ural Mountains, so they never went into Asia.
And you were born where?
I was born in Kyrgyzstan, which is on the Russian-Chinese-Afghanistani border.
You were a little baby when you started that trek, huh?
I was born after the war. My father and mother met in 1944. My mother was 18 at the time when she got married, and she had me when she was 19. And because my father was a Polish citizen, we could leave Russia, and we left Russia and went to Poland initially and ultimately to this place, persons camp in Kassel, Germany.
Your family had to deal with losing a lot of people during the Holocaust.
My father, the reason my father survived is because he didn't stay behind. My father crossed into Russia, and that he was in a gulag, but he survived. His parents, his brothers, his sisters, all went to Auschwitz. One brother survived, actually, my Uncle David, who lives in Denver, Colorado now, who was in Auschwitz in the Birkenau, is the only one to survive from my father's family.
Survivors of the Holocaust are different than those who are directly affected. Is that right? I mean, you have a different perspective on what that was like and how you live, remembering all that right now.
You know, I was not, as I said, my grandparents on my father's side were killed in the Holocaust. My parents were not Holocaust survivors in the sense that went into Russia and were not in concentration camps. But family members were, and as I said, my father's entire family was wiped out, and that obviously has an effect on your family, has an effect on how you're raised, what you thought, what you believe.
Give me an example of that.
Surviving specifically, I mean, talking about me personally, I was a baby, going from Russia back into Poland. I don't remember, but I was told that my mother could not breastfeed me. And my grandfather would chew. We were on trains. My grandfather would chew stale black bread and then spit it into my mouth so I could eat and survive. Being told that as a child and as a grown-up and understanding that what happens has an effect on you.
Made you a tough guy in court. You think
you a tough guy.
And do you feel, does that impact on you when you go in a case where there's where people are being evicted? Do you think of that, the eviction and being thrown out of one country to another?
Absolutely. Obviously, that experience and the stories I've heard have influenced my decisions as to what I wanted to do, what I was comfortable doing. I like representing the underdog, and I've been successful in doing that. And that's it's nice to be able to do that.
And then Israel.
From the displaced persons camp in Germany in 1948, we moved to Israel. And I was in Israel from 1948 to 1961.
Displaced persons camp, what a name.
That's what it was called. That was what it's called. But they had these people from all over who survived the Holocaust, ended up in Germany, most of them in Germany, and the Americans, the English, the French, created camps for people who displaced in the sense that you lost everything. I mean, both my father's father had property in Poland. My grandfather, my mother's father, had substantial property in Bessarabia. It was all lost, was never recovered, could never be recovered. And you ended up as a displaced person with nothing. And the American government nicely was feeding you after the war.
And you got to Israel after 1948 when it became
immediately after the war. After independence in 1948, we went to Israel.
And could you give me an idea of what that was like living then? A little country by then, way back then.
It was, when we arrived in Israel, we were living in tents on the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, you arrive in a country, you have no home, you have no job, you have no profession, you don't know what you're going to do. And my father and grandfather, I mean, my mother's father survived the war and always lived with us. They went to look for a place to live, and they ended up in Jaffa, and they found a place to live in Jaffa. And we moved from the tent we were living in to Jaffa and at that point, it was actually the area I was in, lived in, was between Jaffa and Bat Yam, and it was a really mixed area with a lot of Arab. Jaffa had a substantial Arab population. And the neighborhood, the street I lived on, had both Jews and Arabs, Palestinians.
Then, finally, America.
In 1961, my father decided that he had his only living relative, basically, was his brother, who was in America, in the Bronx. And my father decided to come to America, and I was brought along.
In the Bronx?
In the Bronx. In the Bronx.
Roosevelt High School?
Theodore Roosevelt High School, yes. I came to Theodore Roosevelt High School. I was somehow, they decided that they interviewed me and decided I should become a junior at Theodore Roosevelt High School. I spoke English not very well because I took it as a foreign language. I didn't study so hard. So I was not very good at English, but became a junior at Theodore Roosevelt High School and graduated from Theodore Roosevelt High School.
Then CCNY for free. That seems to be an issue, whether people should get free tuition. City College of New York.
City College of New York was and is a great institution. It gave me an opportunity to go to college. My parents, as I said, we came in 1961. I go to college in 1963. My parents were really not in the position to send me to a private university. I did not speak English even that well. Even at that point, I spoke English, but not that well. I was not going to win any scholarships to go to any universities, to Ivy League colleges.
You weren't Harvard bound.
I was not Harvard bound. I did not speak English well enough to be Harvard bound. But I went to City College at night initially and then matriculated and graduated from City College. And it allowed me, my recollection is that my tuition was either $36 or $38 a semester. And it allowed me to go to college.
Then Rutgers Law School.
Rutgers Law School again.
Why did you decide to become a lawyer?
I decided very early, very early. I mean, once I came to America, I was in high school, when I was in college, I decided that I wanted to be a lawyer. I thought that that I had the personality for it, I had an interest in it. I did not mind war, so I decided to become a lawyer.
And you studied with some of the best First Amendment people in the world, Frank Askin, Arthur Kanoy, people who are constitutionally considered some of the most important lawyers in the country.
At the time, Rutgers Law School still is a wonderful law school, but at the time it was sort of a center of a lot of the progressive constitutional lawyers, as I said, Arthur Kanoy, Frank Askin, and it was a very good place to be at the time. We have to remember it's Vietnam War, very good time. A very good time to spend time in that law school.
And I assume that's what influenced you to begin to work as director of litigation services in the Bronx.
Yeah,
also. Taking care of some of the most vulnerable people you could find anywhere. The Bronx was burning, and there you were.
Yeah. I became director of litigation at South Bronx Legal Services, which was an office created specifically to represent tenants. When legal services got to the Bronx, tenants were not represented. Nobody could afford a lawyer, and tenants were unrepresented until legal services appeared on the scene. And the Bronx was a very strange place, and that court was a very strange place at that point. There was no warranty of habitability defense in New York State, which means that your obligation to pay rent was separate from the landlord's obligation to provide you with services. Warranty of habitability became a law in the state of New York in 1975. So in 1971, 72, 73, 74, no warranty of habitability defense, which means when tenants used to go, there used to be one judge in assigned to landlord-tenant, both commercial and residential in the Bronx. When tenants appeared, as I said, they were not represented. The calendar used to end, finish by 1 o'clock, because everyone walked out with a final judgment. If you had repairs, the judge will tell the landlord, please do the repairs, but the tenant will walk out with a final judgment to pay the rent, and if they couldn't pay the rent or would not pay the rent, they would be evicted. Once legal services arrived at the scene, specifically us at South Bronx Legal Services, tenants suddenly got representation.
I think from what I've read and what we talked about before, that you were as loved back then as you were now. Didn't you have an incident where a landlord took out some bullets to try to convince you that maybe your argument wasn't as well thought out as it should be?
What happened was I was representing a group of tenants in a rent strike on University Avenue. And we were in front of a judge. At that point, the housing court was already there. It was in the basement of 861 Grand Concourse, the courthouse, which you see from Yankee Stadium. It was in the basement of that building, very small rooms, hundreds of people milling around waiting for their cases to be heard. And I was in a courtroom, in a very small courtroom in front of a judge by the name of Thomas Sinclair, a wonderful judge. And I'm arguing a case, and to the left of me is the landlord and his attorney. And I look over, and he's counting bullets. He's passing bullets from one hand to the other, obviously to try to intimidate me.
Didn't work, huh?
Did not. They emptied. I mentioned it to the judge that he was counting bullets, and the courtroom was vacated, and everybody was searched when they wanted to come back. At that point, it's interesting that you could walk into a courthouse with bullets and a pistol. Today, as you know, you go to any court in New York, I mean, you have to go through scanners and, it could not happen today.
But at that point,
you could just walk in and count bullets in a courtroom to try to intimidate the lawyer representing the tenants against you.
This conversation is with Alan Walper with David Rosenhaus, a lawyer who specializes in representing tenants facing evictions due to demolition. What's going to happen from now on in the New York City? Here we are. It's sort of 216. It seems like the real estate industry is hotter and hotter and hotter. Prices are going higher and higher and higher. What's going to happen to the city?
I've always thought that what allowed New York City to be great, for artists to live in New York City, for writers to live in New York City, for teachers to live in New York City, for cops to live in New York City, was basically rent control and rent stabilization, where rents were regulated, and as a result, they were affordable. What is happening now is slowly rent control and rent stabilization are being dismantled. As a result, people, working people, cannot afford to live in New York City. Because once an apartment is decontrolled, it goes to market, and the market will control what the rent would be. And people who are the backbone of New York City cannot afford to live here, which is not good for New York City.
The New York City that you knew when you first came here from Israel?
The New York City I knew. The New York City I knew. They started, so this, under the Pataki administration, they started to...
Governor Pataki.
Governor Pataki was a Republican and a Republican state senate, which were... much of the money to elect upstate state senators, upstate assembly people, is New York City real estate money.
Well, people know that this seems to be something that everybody talks about, and that is that there's a need to have a middle class sensibility in a big city. And you're not the only one who said these kind of things.
Of course.
But why is it happening? Oh, is it because the politicians are not listening, because they're getting too much money from the landlords or from the developers? Or do they not understand how important it is to have a diverse city, a middle-class city with middle-class values?
Let me just say, the politicians who understand that, the progressive politicians who understand that, the problem is that in terms of rent control and rent stabilization, it is not controlled by the city council. It is not controlled by the mayor. It's controlled by the state. It's a state agency. And where you have state senators and assembly people from upstate New York who do not have a constituency in New York City and do not have to be responsive to voters in New York City, who get much of their money from real estate interests in New York City, they vote to support the interests of the real estate industry.
So Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and all those people upstate don't really care about what's happening downstate?
Two
different countries, huh?
So it's two different countries. I mean, a politician wants to get elected, is trying to raise money, and he raises money from those who are willing to give him money. And the real estate industry in New York is willing to support politicians who would support their position. It is much more difficult, let me just say, New York City politicians get most of the money from real estate interests. But because their audience, the people who vote for them, are New York City residents, who they have a very difficult time voting against the interest of their constituents. Upstate politicians have no problem doing that.
David Rosenhaus, lawyer, and I must say activist, thanks for sharing your courtroom and professional life with us.
My pleasure.
I suspect you'll have many more memorable legal battles ahead of you.
I have them as we speak. I have many right now.
Thank you. John Wolper is the senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is our executive producer. Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer. You can sit back and enjoy any one of our more than 125 autobiographies by Googling Conversations with Alan Wolper, or you can catch up with us on Twitter. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.